This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ever wondered if you are as happy, as successful, as motivated, as self-confident, as at peace with yourself, or even as thin as you'd like to be? Let me rephrase. Have you come across the book titled Redirect? The full title is actually Redirect, the Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. It's filled with research studies showing how people with all manner of challenges were able to create remarkable improvement by making slight edits in the stories they tell themselves. If you've got an idea what sort of psychological change you'd like for yourself, do stay tuned. Redirect author Dr. Tim Wilson is with us, and you will certainly be welcome to talk with him right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled Redirect, the Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Its author, research psychologist Timothy Wilson, is our guest. And if at any point you find you have questions for him or a story of your own to share, please do call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Dr. Tim Wilson, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Tom, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, Dr. Wilson, in your very first chapter, you tell a quite moving story. The challenges some long-cherished notions in mental health. This story involves a police officer in Florida and something commonly referred to as CISD, which I believe stands for Critical Incident Stress Debriefing.
Yes.
So tell us some about police officer Gary Felice and why you think his story is so pertinent to your overall message that you would start with it.
Sure. Well, this police officer was on patrol in Tampa, Florida a number of years ago with his partner, and he was alerted that there was a fire in a nearby house. So he and his partner jumped out and ran up to the house. And to their horror, they could hear screams from within the house of a man who was trying to escape but couldn't. And this was a tragic outcome in that the man died in the fire because the police officers were unable to get to him in time. He had burglar bars across the door, and it took them a while to break in. Well, this incident, not that unusual for a first responder, but there's a twist to it that it turns out that the police officer, Gary Felice, when he saw an article about it in the paper the next day, realized he knew this guy, that he was an acquaintance of his that he had known for years. And as you can imagine, this was just terribly upsetting. And he had trouble. He had nightmares. He had trouble recovering from this. So his department did what many police and fire departments do. They suggested that he undergo this procedure called CISD, which is used throughout the country to help not only first responders, but anyone who experiences a trauma. And the basic idea is that you sit down as soon as possible after the event and relive it with the help of a counselor who asks you in detail exactly what happened, try to recount everything you can remember about it, with the assumption that it's very cathartic to do so, that if you can get it out and speak about it in as much detail as possible, that this will let the demons out and you can move on with your life. Well, the reporter who interviewed this police officer noted that even a couple of years after this, Gary Felice, unfortunately, just couldn't get this image of his burned friend out of his mind. And what makes this such a poignant example is there's lots of research showing that this is one of the worst things you can do to somebody after a trauma, is to have them relive it in such detail. It makes some sense from the perspective of common sense that speaking and talking about something would help. But in this case, there's even evidence that it can solidify our memories for something, and that maybe what's best is what we naturally do is go home and distract ourselves, play with our kids, watch TV, forget about it as much as we can, at least in the short run, to let it settle down a little bit. and not relive it, because, as I said, doing so can actually make us remember it better than we want to.
Dr. Tim Wilson, that's fairly remarkable, because I think most people listening have heard stories where there's been some sort of violence or a horrific storm, and among the aftermath aid efforts are teams of therapists who go in to help people talk about the experience as soon as possible after the experience. And it sounds like what you're saying is there's pretty good scientific evidence that that's a bad thing.
Well, yes, and I certainly don't want to diss all the therapists out there, and there are many good ones who I think know that this is not advisable, but unfortunately...
Well, tell us about the scientific evidence. How do you come to the conclusion that it is, in fact, a bad thing?
Well, there's a number of studies that use the good old scientific method, where they take people who have experienced a trauma, and they randomly assign them to undergo the CISD procedure, or to a control group that doesn't, or maybe some other sort of therapy. And then they track these people, often for months or years, and see how well they've recovered. And a number of these studies have found that the people who were randomly assigned to do the CISD fare no better, and in some cases worse, than those who are just left to their own devices.
And you come back to this idea in this book, Redirect, of story editing over and over again. Tell us what that is. Give us the overview and show us, if you would, Dr. Tim Wilson, how that might apply to a better approach to the aftermath of some horrific experience.
Sure. Well, one reason I opened the book with this example is it introduces this idea of the narratives we tell ourselves, the stories that we all construct to understand who we are and our place in the world and what's happened to us. And often our well-being depends on what those stories are all about and how good a story it is, in a sense. And Tom, maybe this is a good time to read just a paragraph or two from the book where I...
Page 10 of the first chapter, I think you're on.
Yes. So... this is a section called Story Editing. This is a new approach that began with the theorizing of Kurt Lewin, who helped found the field of social psychology in the 1930s and 1940s. Lewin champions the subjectivist view, namely that in order to understand why people do what they do, we have to view the world through their eyes and understand how they make sense of things. But he had a more radical insight. Not only do we need to view a problem through other people's eyes, we can also change the way they view it with relatively simple interventions. True, people's self-views are often embedded in years of family dynamics, personal relationships, and cultural forces, and we can't expect people to revise those views overnight. If a teenager is a rebel without a cause, it doesn't do much good for his parents to implore, please change your view of yourself, any more than it would be to say, I would appreciate it if you would lay off the crystal meth, lose the lip piercing, and take flute lessons. Narratives are often like an oil painting to which we add a little daub each day. Revising that narrative would mean scraping away layers of paint and starting over again with a fresh canvas. A daunting task, to say the least. But as Lewin noted, sometimes it is possible to change people's interpretations fairly easily if we find just the right approach. And since then, new generations of social psychologists have refined Lewin's ideas into an approach I call story editing, which is a set of techniques designed to redirect people's narratives about themselves and the way they view themselves that leads to lasting changes in behavior.
Give us an example.
Well, so one thing about this example of Gary Felice is there are other techniques that can help us change our own stories in relatively simple ways. And I refer to some writing exercises that psychologists have developed. So someone might ask, well, what should have Gary Felice's department done to help him? And here's what the research suggests is let him alone for a little while. See how this event, see if it settles down and it doesn't haunt him. But if it does, There are some writing exercises that basically people are asked to take out pen and paper, and for about 10 or 15 minutes each night before you go to bed, maybe three or four nights in a row, to write about your most basic feelings and ideas. Open up about the event, not right after it happened, but after a few weeks have passed, where you have a little more of an opportunity to gain some perspective and find meaning in it. If we haven't been able to make sense of some terrible thing, with some perspective, writing the simple writing exercise allows us to do so.
Well, it seems to me that I recall one section of your book, Dr. Tim Wilson, Redirect, where you talk about one of these scientific studies where they divide people into four random groups. And I think one writing assignment is to write about feelings. One writing assignment is to write about reasons. Another writing assignment is to try and put some distance from the event that you're writing about, but with that more distant perspective to write about one's feelings. And then the fourth group is to put some distance between yourself and the event that you're writing about, but then write about reasons why you think things happened. Can you give us maybe an example of a particular event somebody might be writing about, and which one of those four ends up being the most successful way to write about it?
Sure. So this is some research from some psychologists at the University of Michigan. And let's take an example. Suppose that something happened to you at your workplace where your boss just really made you angry. Maybe there's some sort of conflict and your boss treated you in a completely unreasonable way, and you got into maybe a little bit of a yelling match. And this is a terrible event that's been stewing around for a while. So you take out a piece of paper, and how should you write about that? And as you say, Tom, there's a variety of ways you might do it. You might just try to relive it and feel those feelings all over again. Or you might try to write more about why you think this event happened. And you might try to immerse yourself in it from a first-person perspective. Or you might pretend you're a fly on the wall looking at the event from a third-person perspective. And it turns out that the combination of those that works best is fly on the wall, write about reasons. So the more dispassionate approach, look at it as if you were somebody else. And
so I'm a fly on the wall kind of imagining why my boss was acting the way he was.
Yeah, it leads to some reinterpretation typically. So you go, okay, you know, I just assumed he was a complete jerk, but now I see I'm a little bit more where he was coming from, and I still think I'm right, but I understand the context, and something that happened earlier in the day maybe set me off, and it just gives us some distance and perspective that allows us to move on, understand it better, and move on.
And the scientists who were studying these various techniques, obviously, you've identified that it is the fourth, the fly in the wall, writing about reasons, that's the most effective. But how effective was it?
Well, the measures they used were people's feelings they reported, that people who did this say that they feel better about the event. In some of their studies, they have some physiological measures of blood pressure, for example, where people seem calmer after writing in this way. So on a variety of measures, people seem to feel better about what happened.
And a variety of measures, if I recall correctly, some of the typical ways that we think of doing some sort of therapeutic event, focusing on feelings, when the people in the groups that were doing that, they found all kinds of ways they actually got worse.
Well, they can, and I think anger is a particularly good example of this, that we've all been there where we're reliving it just makes us angry again, and it's almost as if we were there again, and it's harder to move on.
The book is titled Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Its author, research psychologist Tim Wilson, is our guest, and there is a section later in your book with a different kind of writing theme, where people actually lost weight without even intending to. So I want to ask you about that and invite you listening to call in if you'd like to at 888-WMRA-TALK. So to you who are listening, Have you ever undergone any form of mental health therapy or know someone who has? How'd that work out? Were there techniques you discovered that you found helpful, others not so much? If you'd be willing to tell us about it, 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Tim Wilson is the Aston Professor of Psychology at the University of Virginia. His latest book is titled Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Tim, one of the things that I have the sense that you think is of almost overwhelming benefit in dealing with psychological challenge is a phrase I've heard you use sometime. I think it's lowering the heat.
Yes, I think there are, often the things that upset us the most are those that are hard to understand and that we keep obsessing about or are threatening to us in some way. And there's another writing exercise which psychologists call self-affirmation, which I know sounds awfully kind of self-helpy, but this is based on good science where people who remind themselves of things they value and how important they are can kind of turn down the heat in areas of their lives that they find stressful.
And there's an example, I think there was a study at Stanford.
Yes, so there's many examples of this, but the one I think you're referring to is one that was done with college women who were trying to lose weight. And any of us who have been there know how difficult it can be to struggle with a diet and to shed a few pounds. But in this particular study, they simply had the women do this so-called self-affirmation writing exercise where they picked a value that was particularly important to them.
Often, well, back up for just a moment. They're handed a list of different ideas or words that epitomize certain kinds of values, whether it's, I don't know, optimism or kindness or compassion or thriftiness.
Yes, or else areas of their lives that they might particularly value. So family, relationships, religion, the kind of things.
And so they're simply asked to pick one of those that they feel resonates for them and then just write about it?
Yes, about why it's important to them. So probably the most common thing people write about are relationships and family.
They go through this fairly short, simple writing exercise?
Well, the idea is that when you then leave the study and are in a situation you find a little stressful, say you're going to a party and there's lots of food there and yet you're trying to lose weight, that it gives you a little more of a reservoir of strength to control your behavior. Just reminding yourself of what's really important to you in life and gives you strength to meet challenges.
So this phrase that I've heard you use before, Tim, lowering the heat, the way that you think this works is that instead of focusing on a problem, whether it's trying to lose weight or anything else, that people are focusing on something that they see as a positive value in their life. And having written about it, they've got more of a story in their mind of how important it is to them. They end up feeling better about themselves, I guess, because they've identified this thing that helps them feel like a good person. They've identified something worthwhile that's important to them. And it lowers the heat on the negative stuff.
Seems to be, and I know it sounds magical, but another example of this is these same researchers did a version of this study with middle school students in a school in New England where about half the students were black and half were white. And this school, like many others, had an achievement gap where the white students were doing better than the black students on average. These researchers went into an English class and had the students do this little self-affirmation writing exercise three or four times during the semester where they picked a value and wrote about why it was important to them. And this had no effect on the white students, presumably because academics is not an area where most of them felt particularly threatened. But the black students, who were struggling, it had a remarkable effect. It basically closed the achievement gap by about 40%. And as best we know, this worked in just the way you're describing, Tom, where After doing these exercises, when these kids were then faced with a stressful academic situation, they had kind of in the back of their heads the idea that, you know, I'm a good person, I really value some things in life, and I can meet this challenge.
There's a psychological phenomenon that you talk about at some length in your book, Redirect. I don't remember the exact term, but it has to do with stereotype bias. I want
stereotype threat.
Okay,
yes.
That relates to what you were just telling us, and I do want to make time to ask you more about that. But we're now starting to get some calls. So for anybody who's just tuned in, our guest is research psychologist Tim Wilson. His new book is titled Redirect: The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Our phone number is easy to remember: is 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. But we're going to go next to Charlottesville. Carolyn, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for Dr. Wilson, please.
Hello. Yes, thank you so much. I'm really enjoying this this topic. And I underwent a trauma recently. I was diagnosed with cancer in December, and I was at the wonderful Emily Couric Center, and I'm doing very well now. But and I'm working with a social worker, and she suggested that exactly what you're saying is that I write down, you know, how I was dealing with this, that I keep a journal. And I was wondering, because we also meet in a group therapy with other cancer victims, if you find that gender has a role in how people, whether they want to talk about it or whether they're better off not talking about, you know, the exact trauma, because I find that I kind of wanted to talk about, you know, what I was going through, but I could understand with your story about the police officer very much that he was better off just, you know, not talking about it. And so I just wanted to confirm that, yes, writing about it is excellent, but I was wondering about the gender roles here.
Well, Carolyn, thanks for calling and sharing that. You know, I think it's not so much gender as it is timing, that the research on these writing exercises generally finds that men and women benefit from them. I think in the case of the police officer, the problem was that he was asked to do it so soon after it happened. Now, that said, I do think the stereotype is true a little bit, that women are more apt to share personal experiences with their friends, and whereas men are more apt to clam up. But I think as far as the writing exercises go, that generally both men and women do benefit from them.
But does it matter what you focus on when you're writing?
Well, I think the goal is to lead to a reinterpretation of your traumatic events in a way that helps you understand it better. And that's hard to do just deliberately, to say, okay, I'm going to understand it. But I think through the process of opening up and writing and exploring your feelings, I should mention that this writing exercises often are not much fun to actually do in the present, that if you're writing about some terrible event in your life, often people cry, become upset. So they're hard to do, but the long-term benefits are study after study finds that it just gives us a little different perspective on them that helps us understand them better.
Carolyn, I'm curious. You said that you both do group therapy and that you've done this journaling.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that part of what Dr. Wilson is identifying in his book, Redirect, is that in a number of different writing exercises, it helps people step back a little bit, get a little distance from whatever the problem is, and get a different perspective. I'm curious if you feel that is something that you would say works for you when you're writing?
Yes. You know, it's interesting in that I have told my group and my social worker that being diagnosed with cancer was one of the worst and one of the best things that ever happened to me, because writing it ended up not talking about just the cancer, but all sorts of other little problems that have been in my life, you know, other hurts and other worries that I was able to confront or deal with, or something that I had just put on the back burner and never wanted to face. And so I felt it, that I've had a healing experience with many things because of this one traumatic event. And so I was wondering if people find that you know, that one traumatic event triggers remembering everything else bad that ever happened to you, and sometimes you can sort of heal them all at the same time.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, I do think that is certainly the goal, and often it is what happens, just opening up and thinking about one's deepest feelings or taking a perspective. And I should mention, Tom, that I think there are a variety of ways these writing exercises can work, and sometimes the fly on the wall one is best, but for some people, really just delving into the feelings can also be helpful. And often you're just not quite sure where that's going to lead. It may lead to other things in your life that you find beneficial to think about.
Carolyn, thank you so much for sharing such a powerful experience with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm very, very much enjoying this program.
Thank you.
The book is titled Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Its author, research psychologist Tim Wilson, is our guest. If you'd like to talk to him, we've got a phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on our Facebook page. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we have another Carolyn, actually, who posted on Facebook a short time ago with this question, Dr. Wilson. She says, I would like to know how to leave the past behind and not keep obsessing on a past mistake.
Well, Tom, this gives me an opportunity to say something that I think is important to add, that I am a believer in psychotherapy. And there are times when writing just doesn't quite do it for us. And if people really have longstanding problems that they're unhappy about, then the research also shows that psychotherapy can be very effective. But for problems where we haven't gotten to the point where we feel we need to seek a therapist, these writing exercises, not to sound like a broken record, but I think sitting down with pen and paper can be very effective. And I think, why don't more of us do that? Well, again, it's hard to do in the moment, and a lot of times it's easier just to not think about something that's troubling us. But just trying it, writing, give it a try and then see if it helps.
Tell us about stereotype threat.
Well, stereotype threat is a phenomenon whereby people are at double jeopardy when they're in a stressful situation. So let's take an African-American student who is taking a difficult test in school. On the one hand, they have the concern that all of us have, that they want to do well. They have a personal stake in doing well on this test. But unlike some of us, they have a second concern, namely that they might confirm a stereotype about their group, that if they do poorly, it will reflect badly on African-Americans. So they have these two concerns at the same time. They want to do well, but they don't want to confirm a stereotype. And that's a lot to worry about. And the research shows that this extra worry actually inhibits performance, that having to worry about these two things makes it harder to concentrate on what the question's asking and doing well. And simply removing that threat in a variety of ways can boost the performance of African Americans. Same is true with women taking math tests, that a woman wants to do well on this test, but she has maybe in the back of her mind the fear that she'll confirm the stereotype that women aren't as good at math. And a variety of ways have shown that reducing stereotype threat can really boost people's performance. One is the self-affirmation writing exercise we've talked about before. Other studies show simply telling people, look, there's no gender or race effects on this test you're taking, removes the threat and lets people concentrate better.
For anybody who's just joined us especially, recap the self-affirmation writing?
That's the one where you just think about some aspect of your life that you really value and spend a few moments writing about why that is. So about your relationships, your religious beliefs, your values. Just pick what's important to you and remind yourself of why.
For people who are not in a group where they feel stereotyped, in a negative way, it may be hard to identify. And even some people who are in a group women taking a math test. They may not think that they're worried about this, but there's been a fair amount of research that shows that they are.
Yes, and you know, we all belong to groups that have some stereotype associated with it. And, you know, if we're lucky, we're going to become old, and there are stereotypes about old people, that about memory loss and so on. And the same phenomenon has been shown there. If you give an older person a memory test, they're worried, A, that they'll do poorly, but also that they'll confirm the stereotype that they're an old fogey who can't remember anything. And just removing that threat actually improves memory in older folks.
Well, if it's not a too personal a question to you who are listening, what kind of stories do you typically tell yourself about yourself? Are there ways that you see some of those stories as self-limiting, or that there's something you'd like to change about how you see yourself? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. If you want to talk with the author of the book Redirect, research psychologist Tim Wilson. On Facebook, by the way, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. One of the things that you come back to with some frequency in your book, Tim, is a huge dissatisfaction, I think it would be fair to say, that you have with how many efforts are going on in our society to help people that don't help, that often hurt, but perhaps worst of all, have been implemented without any rigorous testing or examination. Tell me more about that.
Sure. Well, that is a sub-theme of the book, that not only do we have to think about people's stories that they tell themselves, but when we're trying to change them, we have to be very careful to use techniques that have been vetted scientifically. And, you know, as straightforward as that sounds, it's remarkable how seldomly it is done or done well in the arena of interventions designed to help people. There's all sorts of examples of programs that are very well-meaning. The people who design them are dedicated folks who really want to help, but they don't test it in a way. And, you know, one analogy I give in the book is to the medical world. I mean, imagine I told you this story that I've come up in my basement with a cure for a disease. Let's pick one. Let's say diabetes. And I went down to my basement and I mixed up some plants from my garden and some chemicals I found on the internet. And I've come up with this drug that I think can cure diabetes. Would anyone in their right mind take my drug without it being tested on animals and humans? I don't think so, because we know that who knows if it really works and it might actually harm people. But we don't apply that same standard to interventions and social programs. We just kind of go by common sense. So things like the DARE drug program, Scared Straight programs are examples of a critical incident debriefing that we talked about earlier, that things that seems like they should work, but in fact they don't.
And you go over a fair amount of scientific evidence that shows that DARE does not work, and that Scared Straight actually causes harm.
Yes.
So I want to ask you more about that. We have to pause for the break. I also want to let James in Edinburgh know that he will be our next call when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Dr. Timothy Wilson has authored and co-edited a number of books, among those titles Strangers to Ourselves, The Handbook of Self-Knowledge, plus a college textbook on social psychology that is now in its seventh edition. But it is his latest single author volume that is our focus today, titled Redirect. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Tell us about Scared Straight. Remind people what it is and then what the science says about it.
Sure. Well, about 20 years ago, there were some inmates in a prison in New Jersey, hardened inmates, who many of whom had life sentences, who decided they wanted to try to help and give back. And they helped start this program whereby at-risk teenagers were brought to the prison, and these inmates would confront them, scream at them, yell at them, tell them, look, you should do anything but end up like me behind these bars. And the notion was one that makes common sense, that by scaring these kids, showing them what would happen if they joined a gang and got caught doing something terrible, that this would convince them to walk the straight line. This became the subject of a documentary that was very popular. Programs sprung up like it all over the country. There's a current show on television now called Beyond Scared Straight that shows how these programs work. Well, the sad thing is that these programs were put into place before they were tested scientifically. And now that they have been, and I refer to studies where they take a bunch of kids and they randomly assign them to take part in Scared Straight or to a control group that does not, I believe there are 7 or 8 such studies. All of them show the Scared Straight actually increases criminal behavior in the kids who go through it. Now, no one knows exactly why this is. There's a couple of theories out there. One is it turns out when you have at-risk teens, one of the worst things you can do is bring them together. They like to show off for each other and show bravado, and they're not bothered by this. And there's a variety of other reasons why this might be, but back to my medical example, it's like we put a drug on the market before testing it and finding out that it actually does more harm than good. The same is true with Scared Straight.
You identify some programs that are aimed at preventing teenage pregnancy, where the science is showing the same thing, that those who are participating in the program, there's actually a higher rate of teenage pregnancy?
Yes, there's a number of programs there that do more harm than good. And what makes this especially galling to a research psychologist like me is that there's pretty good science out there of what does work. And the teenage pregnancy one, there is actually a program that has been well-tested in high schools that this may seem a little paradoxical, but one of the best things you can do to teenagers is to get them involved in volunteer work. There's programs where as part of kids' health classes, they're required to pick a community agency and volunteer. So it might be a daycare center or an old folks home or whatever, and the kids commit to a certain number of hours a week. And that, believe it or not, lowers the teenage pregnancy rate of the girls who take part and improves the grades of everyone. Why is that? Well, the crass answer is if you're volunteering, you're not home having sex with your boyfriend or girlfriend. But I think it's more than that. I think it's changing kids' stories. They feel more involved in their community as a function of doing the volunteer work. They feel perhaps more of a future if they're helping somebody else. And so that's an example of a really well-tested program.
Well, to you on the other side of your radio, what do you think of the idea that helping programs aimed at assisting people in overcoming some form of disadvantage should be scientifically tested before they're implemented? Can you think of exceptions to that approach? Or conversely, programs that you wish had been put through some sort of rigorous testing process? 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number and all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. James in Edinburgh, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for Dr. Tim Wilson, please.
Great show. This crosses so much territory, I don't know where to begin. But the affirmation process, it's similar to being having gratitude for what goes on. And it reminds me that, well, energy equals MC squared, so matter is a denser form of energy. If we're in a physical activity, it tends to reinforce, like the writing activity, reinforce our thoughts, which are more ethereal. It goes along with the whole aspect of creation being a dream within a dream and consciousness itself, and the interrelation of chemical resonance in body systems and muscle memory. And
well, James, you noted that this reminds you of lots of things.
So hold on just a second,
because I want to ask Tim Wilson to focus on one. Tim, you don't ever say this in your book, but I am reminded of a kind of metaphysical philosophy that I've seen in lots of other books that I wonder if you agree with, based on the things I have heard from you. And that is the notion that we tend to experience in our lives what we've set up our expectations around. Or another way of putting that is we tend to get more of what we focus on. So if we focus on the problem and how terrible and awful things were and rile up those feelings over and over again, we stay focused on that. But if we go for the kind of affirmation exercises that you're talking about occasionally here, that gives us a different focus that brings, as I guess James would say, more positive light into our daily lives?
Sure. Well, there is. I do talk a fair amount about optimism and how important it is. But I think we have to be careful about how we say that and why. So there are a lot of self-help books out there that basically say, think positively and life will give you what you want. And that's sort of true and sort of isn't true. So unlike some books, I'll mention one, if I may, The Secret, which is a huge bestseller and then basically says that all we have to do to get what we want is to think a positive thought towards it and somehow magically that thing will appear. Well, unfortunately not. That just having a positive thought by itself isn't going to make the love of your life materialize or make you win the lottery. On the other hand, as you suggest, Tom, having a positive attitude that enables us to work harder for getting what we want is the key. I mean, imagine two people who they're trying to get something and they come up against some barrier. So they're a student who's struggling or someone who's having a problem with their boss or whatever. You know, we all encounter barriers in our lives. The optimist is the one who says, okay, there's got to be a way around this. There's something I can do to overcome this barrier. It's the pessimist who, you know, goes to bed and pulls the cover up over their eyes. And obviously the positive thinker who's looking for things they can do to accomplish their goals is the one who's more apt to get there.
James, thank you so very much for your call. Dr. Tim Wilson, author of this book, Redirect: The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Talk to us about parenting.
Well, it's a great topic, and I have a chapter in the book on it, because if you think about it, our job as parents is to help our kids develop good stories. Obviously, we need them to be healthy, and there are other goals, but I think that one of the primary points of being a good parent is to instill in our kids a good story about themselves and the world. And that's not always easy to do. Let me tell you a quick story that I think illustrates this. Last Saturday, I went down to the Charlottesville Farmers Market, and it was a beautiful day, lots of people there. And there was a family, a mother and a father, that had young kids. And one of them, who I would say was probably about 4 or 5, noticed that at one of the stands, there was a jug of lemonade with a spigot where customers could serve themselves and then pay the vendor for the drink. And it was a hot day, so the kid, he didn't know you were supposed to pay for this. He just grabbed a cup and went for the spigot and was about to pour himself a glass of lemonade, at which point his mother just shrieked in a voice that it brought the entire market to a standstill, I think. She just yelled, "Don't do that!" And now, let me be quick to add that I don't know what was going on in her life, and maybe it was a very stressful time for her. Maybe she'd been up all night with one of her kids sick, who knows? But I was really struck by just the severity of the way in which she yelled at him. And thinking about it from the story perspective, what did the kid learn from that? Yes, he learned that you shouldn't get lemonade. But he probably also learned that he has to watch out for the wrath of mom on a lot of occasions, rather than internalizing what is right and wrong. And that's the problem with using punishment or even rewards with too heavy a hand, is that we all do it as parents, and sometimes it's necessary to punish our kids or to reward them. But if we do it to too much of a degree, we're too heavy with the punishment or too heavy with the rewards, we don't instill a sense of autonomy in our kids where they internalize the idea of what's right and what's wrong.
Yeah, you talk in several sections about this idea of helping your children develop autonomy and purpose. Talk some about that here.
Yes. Well, another example as a college professor is the phenomenon of helicopter parents, where it's this increasing phenomenon where parents look over the shoulders, even if they're college kids, jump in very quickly to help solve problems. I used to be the chair of the psychology department at UVA, and I came in one morning, and the secretary told me there was a guy there to see me. Well, it turns out he had flown down from New York that morning to help his daughter because she hadn't gotten her first choice of seminar to take. And he demanded that he was paying out-of-state tuition and how expensive it was, and his daughter deserved to get into this class. Well, she didn't, and he went away. But I've often wondered what lessons she learned from that, that the idea that dad will fix my problems, I don't have to try myself, that's not a good way to develop autonomy. And I know as a parent of two now adult kids how hard it is to step back and watch them stumble, as all kids do. And sometimes we do need to step in, but not with things that they can learn to solve themselves. It's funny, I remembered that case when my daughter was in college because she was having a problem with her advisor. She was in an out-of-state school, and I really had to try hard not to intervene, not to pick up that phone and call her advisor. But I remembered the case of the guy who would come to see me, and I resisted, and wouldn't you know it, she solved the problem herself.
You talk repeatedly in the book, Redirect, about this idea that there are little edits, little changes we can make in the stories that we tell ourselves, in the way we approach problems, in the way we guide our children. Can you give me an example of such an approach in helping a child develop autonomy?
Well, I think the trick, let's talk about rewards and punishments again. There's this fancy phrase we use called the minimally sufficient reward or punishment. And what that simply means is to use the smallest dose of a reward or a punishment to get our kids to do what they should be doing. The smallest dose that's effective, because obviously we want it to be effective, but if it's too large, then the kid's going to explain to themselves, well, I did this to get the reward, or I did this to avoid my mom yelling at me in the city market. If we dial back and just sufficient enough of a reward or a punishment to get our kids to do what we want them to do, they're much more likely to begin to internalize this and say, this is what I want to do. I know what the right thing to do is now. So if you want your kid to read, for example, and you reward them too much, they're going to think they're reading books to get the reward. But if you dial it back and just enough to get them into those books, then they're more apt to think, gosh, I'm reading because I love to do so.
Research psychologist Tim Wilson, we're getting short on time. This is not in your book. This is actually something that I've heard you say. So I want to read you back this quote from you. We all have these stories that we construct and tell ourselves. And if we're not entirely satisfied with that story, there may be ways to change it that can really end up benefiting me. Expand on that in the minute we have left.
Well, I think the best example is, not to sound like a broken record, but these writing exercises that simply reframing things to ourselves, writing about them in a different way, taking a different angle, be that fly on the wall.
Give me as concrete an example as you can.
I think it's when, I was like Carolyn who called earlier, if there's really something troubling in our lives that we just can't get over, something in our relationships perhaps, that just exploring it through writing is a way to reframe it in a way that might give new meaning to it.
Okay. Let's say I'm in a relationship with a person who, it seems to me, does not appreciate me. What am I going to pick to write about that's going to end up changing my perspective or helping that relationship?
I think you're not going to change the person through writing, but you might reframe it in a way that such that the next time that you feel underappreciated, you maybe can reframe it in a way that, oh, it's not, they're not really doing something to hurt me. It's something going on in their lives.
And I'm sorry we're so much out of time, but I just remembered, because this is in a section about relationships in your book, you talk about the George Bailey experience. In essence, that's writing about how your life would be different if someone had not appeared in your life?
Yes. So actually, James, the earlier caller, mentioned gratitude exercises, which can help to think about things in our life we are very grateful for. But even better is to imagine what our life would be like if good things hadn't happened to us, if we hadn't met the person that we love. This is a way to reappreciate what we have.
Like the angel coming down in the movie It's a Wonderful Life and showing us what life would have been like if those good things hadn't happened.
Exactly.
Our guest has been Tim Wilson, the Aston Professor of Psychology at the University of Virginia and author of Redirect, The Surprising New Science of Psychological Change. Tim, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Insight Archives. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work Dr. Wilson is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.